At some point, I was very frustrated when I could not jump and I could not land or something is not happening. You have to take a step back, take a breather, evaluate what's happening, what's going on. It's so important to have a mentor. It's so important to have a coach there who explains to you what you need to do at that moment.
Are you in the process of creating something huge and you want to understand how others have done it? Or have you already found success and still feel something is missing? Then this podcast is for you. Welcome to the Alchemist Lounge, a podcast where Alex Atwood chats with top performers to discover habits, routines, and alchemy that you can put to work in your own life.
Today, I'll be talking to Pauls Pujats. Pauls is an Olympian who's conquering fear one challenge at a time through his new TV show, One Body, One Mind. He competed for Latvia in the pole vaulting competition and did that in 2016 Summer Olympics. He was a finalist, and he was also a finalist at the 2010 World Junior Olympics. So Paul's dream was to become an Olympian and create a living with the things that he loves to do. And from his nonstop training, he actually achieved his dream. So he's going to tell us all about how he achieved that dream. And he's going to tell us about his awesome new TV show, which is going to put him against some of nature's greatest challenges. And one at a time, he's going to look fear in the face. I am so excited to be talking to you, Paul.
I'm feeling very blessed. Thank you. Thank you, Alex, for having me. I really appreciate it. Absolutely. It's always nice talking with you and having just conversation.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. And so tell me what it was like, your childhood in Latvia. Give me a little flavor of that. What was it like growing up there?
I'll start with a different story. I moved here 10 years in the United States, roughly 10 years ago. And one of the biggest reasons why I moved here is actually, it's kind of personal, but my biggest motivation is literally to kind of escape the environment that I was growing up, because it did not feel natural for me to be there. First of all, it did came from the parents. I would say from my father, he's a very military kind of man. And that strict regime that I had all the time was quite tooling on mental health. And when I moved here, I worked really quite extended to my mental health. When I was in Latvia growing up, you know, we did not have that kind of opportunities that you have here in the United States. So it's quite tougher, even just training, you know, traveling from one part to another part. The public transportation was pretty good, but I got to share this with you, with everyone. A lot of times there's always like this two or three people who are there and who just, I don't know, whether they be homeless or they have a bad breath, but man, this tank was so bad.
At the bus stop?
Every time. Inside of transportation, inside of the public transportation.
But the public transportation you were taking also included some characters that were in the in the areas that you were.
Oh, yeah.
So it was possibly dangerous. And
not quite a bit. I recall about at least three instances when I was going to school, back to house, and then even to sometimes to work out. We call them in the local language, gopniki and urlas. So this is an explanation of Latvian or Russian-speaking people, usually about from three people to about eight to nine people, usually. And they're going to go around you, and instead of like in schools where you see bullying, they don't only do that. They also like literally will rob you, like steal everything from you and leave you there.
How old were you?
That's pretty rough. It wasn't like the, you know, childhood you normally would probably have in the United States, I would say. You know, you get the bullying, and after the school, when you get the bullying, you got another level boss that's going to wait until you're going to go home.
Wow.
And that happens all the time. It happens all the time. I wasn't the only one, and that was a huge motivation to get strong and get big.
Wow. So how old were you when you would have to deal with that type of thing, when you maybe getting robbed?
It started as early as I was about 8 years old, like literally as 8, 7 years old. And when I was in my grandparents outside of the city, out of the capital, where I was literally just bullied because I wasn't speaking Russian language. Again, there was like about three, usually older, they were about like at least teenagers, maybe even older, who was just literally bullying you, you know, who was just picking on you. I had no idea what they were talking, because I don't know the Russian language at that time. So that fear actually made me learn the language. It's kind of like something bad, but also at the same time, at least I learned the language and I know what it means now.
Wow.
And it went all the way until age of, I would say, 15. After the age of 15, I got strong. And they usually don't mess with you when they see, you know, someone can actually can threaten their livelihood.
Yeah. So let's unpack that a little bit. So you were in a highly structured, disciplinarian type of household. How many brothers, how many sisters, how many siblings were there in your household with you?
Older brother, he's 3 years older, and two younger sisters. Yeah. And the sisters were about, it's a quite a big difference. I think the oldest sister is 8 years younger than I am. 8 years. Yeah. 8 years. And then an even younger one is about 12 years. 12 years. Yeah.
So, got it. So it was you and your brother, it sounds like, because you were so close in age, that were probably bonded together, like going through the childhood journey together. Yeah.
Yeah, our bonding at that point was a little bit different. We were fighting all the time, literally all the time. And he was 3 years older, and I think it was exact age where like usual older siblings, like, oh, I don't want to mess with that. I don't want to have this younger sibling going around. Like, you know, I felt like a little kid that you got to babysit. But we were fighting all the time until we moved to the college, and then we got real close.
Yeah. Was there competition between you two in terms of athletic? Oh, yeah.
I recall this. He was always so mad when I started to get closer and closer of beating him. I recall that. And funny enough, before the Rio Olympics, he was my coach, actually. He was actually training me.
Wow. So that's wow.
How rivalry went to him actually teaching me and coaching me.
Wow. So, okay, let's talk a little bit about that. When you started to build yourself up as an athlete that is potentially going to be an Olympian. When you were young, was that a dream that you had, making it to the Olympics? Tell me about that. Like, where did it start to where you thought that this could be something you'd want to pursue to a higher level?
When I was about, I think, 13 to 14, I think that was the age, looking at older guys, older athletes, how high they were jumping, and it was about like 5 meters, which is now is not that high. It's high, but like it's not that high. I could not imagine it. So about 17 feet, you know, I'll be jumping something like that. It felt like, whoa, this is crazy. This is so high. Like how? And even like at that point, thinking like I'm going to Olympics, like looking at other athletes, other Olympians, like on the TV, looking at them competing is like, wow, this is crazy. Like I could not imagine, honestly, myself doing that. I just couldn't.
Yeah.
I don't know, maybe because I didn't have someone else like who was already doing this and showing me, a part of like my older brother, but he wasn't jumping as high, you know, as the really professionals, the high level.
But so did he start before you?
We started almost the same time. Yeah. But he was better. He was older, you know, he was stronger, faster. And at that time, he was better until the age of, I would say until age of 16. And then at one point is like, okay, I'm just starting to get better. And then I started competing in international meets. And yeah, and then significantly was better than Ramadar.
Wow. And so that was when you were in high school, yeah? Or no, that was when you'd gotten to college when you started to compete at that level.
Because yeah, it was in high school already.
It was in high school, right. So he was, I guess, out of high school, maybe just a year or so out of high school. And suddenly his brother starts really taking on like higher and higher levels of challenges and meeting them. So let's talk about when you first going through that trajectory of getting really good at pole vaulting, right? Pole vaulting isn't something, at least here in the States, that everyone has access to. Mm-hmm. Do you have access to, or how did you have access to pole vaulting, to the equipment, you know, to all of that? And where did you start to find yourself compounding, right? Where you started to see yourself like incrementally getting better and then suddenly getting a lot better. Tell me about that. Like the equipment, where was it from? And where did you see yourself growing that way?
Yeah, I was very fortunate that, you know, my father was able to afford that kind of equipment because pole vaulting is not cheap to wear. One pole can cost about $800, not just one pole, at least like a whole section of it. Just like a golf, you need a section of clubs that whatever you're going to go and hit, it would be a far hit or a close one. Same thing goes with pole vaulting. Like you need specific, your weight, it needs to be a little bit higher than your weight. And then also the flex number has to be specifically to your strength and your speed. So I was very fortunate that my father was able to afford that and, you know, support us with that. And then we were using basically older poles that they had on the spot in track and field stadium. And inside of the stadium, inside of like the indoor facility, you literally need to have like layers of clothes to feel warm, you know, to even warm up. And sometimes it takes even an hour just to literally just to warm yourself up to the temperature where you feel, okay, now I actually can do something fast. Otherwise you can get injuries. So it's quite, you literally had to work with, from the start, after finishing the school, you had to go back to home. Then you had to travel by yourself with the public transportation. Usually takes about an hour, you know, to go to the facility. When you get to the facility, you need another hour just to warm it up. And then it's important also to cool off. And then you get to see afterwards, travel back in 1 hour. Sometimes we get lucky. My dad can come pick us up and, you know, we can bring us back home. Our friends live pretty close by. So it was fun. You know, it was a fun game at that time. But now looking back, I was like, wow, I did so much. I did so much as a little kid. He was like, no way I'm doing this right now.
Yeah.
And well, when I got to the United States, everything got so much easier. It was just so pleasant because of the weather and the conditions. It was just so much better.
Yeah. You know, when you were like launching into the air and you started to see yourself like getting higher and higher up, can you describe that feeling? Because for me, as someone who's never done it before, when I would watch somebody pole vault, it was a magical, things had to be done in a certain way, something had to land at an exact certain point, and there had to be just the right amount of torque, just the right amount of just to get over that and just to see the body sort of contort around that top pole and to see it sort of sometimes tap, but just enough to leave it there is just pretty magnificent. Mm. But I couldn't see myself doing it. So did you find yourself doing a lot of visualization? Like, were you going through the motion of all of the different points of landing and kind of going through it in your sleep and during the day? And was that something you did?
That came later. That came later when I was in college. I saw actually my roommate, Austin Crenshaw. He was also a pole vaulter at that time. He's my roommate. And, you know, we're also like my competitor. We're competing because we're in the same Memphis track and field, both Tigers, and we're competing with one another. We got a friendly rivalry. And he was watching all these pole vault videos, which I never did before the meet. I was like, why are you watching it right now? Like wondering, like, is that helpful? And then he kind of introduced me with like the visualization, tried to see the jump and kind of mimic it in your mind. And then I did a little bit more research behind of it. I saw there's like this study shown where people who literally were shooting basketball, trying to get into the hoop. And one group, they were shooting it. Another one was not shooting it, but they were visualizing it. So one of them were actually physically throwing in, and then the other group was just visualizing it. And both the groups did the same, just as good as the ones who were training all the time and for those who were visualizing it. So that's when I started to actually practice the visualization. The power of visualization is very, very powerful. But it didn't come easy. It's a practice like anything. Like it's a whole brain training.
Yeah. Yeah. What was it like the first time you had
the jump?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. What was that like? I think it was 13 when the first time I actually could bend the pole. Because before that, I was jumping on straight pole and landing on my feet on the mat. But when I was able to bend it and actually fly up and then jump over the bar and land onto my back, I was like, oh my gosh, I finally jumped. That was the most exciting part, honestly. Like, oh my gosh, like this is such a huge stepping stone. And from a straight pole, you know, landing on the feet, when you actually can jump up and land on your back, you know, because this is where you actually have more air time. And then the better, the more I practiced, the more exciting it became a game. It was a very exciting game. And then when I really started to fly up in the air, then it becomes an art and a whole motion. And then you can even, unfortunately, there's a rule when you jump over the bar and you cannot touch the bar or put it back on, but it's a whole art. You can actually like slightly touch the bar while you fall down, literally put it closer so it stays there. And it's a beautiful art, honestly, but they took it away as like, it's a legal move that you can't do. It doesn't count. But sometimes it depends on the judge. Sometimes the judge allows you to count it as a jump. That's where I feel like I wish they kind of left it, simply because it's just so much more skillful when you can do something like that.
This is fascinating to me. So it's almost as if you, once you're in the air, you can like, it feels like you're almost stopping time for a minute to be able to have enough to be able to kind of just push. Yeah, just kind of push the bar back into where it needs to go as you're landing. Wow. Yeah. So having that experience and landing on your back, Do you see that as cascading to other challenges you're finding in your life in general? Like, once you did that, did things shift any at all from your childhood? Like, wow, I just landed something that I've been working on for, like, what happened after that for you as a kid or even into your adult life?
Or, you know, with excess amount of strength or technicality. So the only thing that I really, why I got to where I was because of my determination. Like, I have a vision, literally just not able to give up. It's something like I keep falling. This is where, honestly, it comes later on where I understand, like, I so encourage everyone to fail as much as you can, because this is where you learn so much. Like, this is where you actually grow. And a lot of times people are afraid to fail. I teach also to other kids, like, always just fail as much as you can. You know, don't be afraid of that, because always looking to succeed and always waiting for that moment, it's never going to come there. Or if it's going to come, it's going to be very lucky as well. And in general, life is also a lot of luck.
Yeah.
So you just got to take chances. And I think what I took away from those jumps, like, you just got to keep trying, you know, just got to get back up there. Keep trying, keep getting there. And don't lose the game. Because at some point, I was like very frustrated when I could not jump and I could not land or something is not happening. You have to take a step back, take a breather, evaluate what's happening, what's going on. It's so important to have a mentor. It's so important to have a coach there who explains you what you need to do at that moment. Very important. So I think those are the main takeaways from my experience.
Yeah. Who was your mentor at that time? Who was being your...
He was a coach. He was an athlete himself at some point. In the Soviet Union, he was one of the best athletes, actually, in pole vaulting. So yeah, his mentality was very old school, though. He did knew more than the average person, you know, I could ask in pole vaulting in Latvia. But in the coaching method, the way he was coaching, I'm grateful for the knowledge that he gave me. But there's a level where he went through and then he stopped. And he stopped learning. And, you know, he just took the old kind of like teachings and that's it. That's all he had, like a template. And I think this is so important to have like multiple mentors, multiple coaches, because you learn so much more from others. And it's also important for the coach, for that mentor to learn with you, because every individual is unique. No one's the same. Like, your technique, your body, your mind thinks differently than anyone else's. This is why you have a specific approach, the way you do things. And that needs to be taken account of when you do something new or try to get better at something. You have to take account of that every individual is unique. No one is the same. So he did not have that mentality. And that's why, like, kind of fighting with a lot of injuries and even like we had a disagreements. And then, you know, it's a disagreement, it's a conflict that's created.
Yeah. Yeah. But it sounds like your evolution just called for different mentors and different partners to come in and support you throughout your journey. Was there a particular moment, maybe when you qualified or maybe when you walked out there representing Latvia, was there a moment there that you felt that there was something beyond you, or were you so into getting it done, just the technicalities of making sure that the jump went well and all of that, that you didn't allow yourself to be distracted by the moment that you were in?
Yeah, I think the two biggest points was when I qualified, because it took so much out of me, physically and mentally, just getting that qualification. It was the last competition indoor, actually, when I was able to qualify for the games. So it's literally last chance. I would train outdoors as well, but I just know if I'm not going to jump it now, outdoors it's going to be, you just cannot predict Mother Nature. Because in pole vaulting, Mother Nature is everything. If it's blowing in the face, if there's rain, like, it's so much difficult. I just wanted to get it done so I could just continuously train, you know, for the Olympics. So I got that qualification in, I think it was February 28th and 2016, actually, yeah. On August, that's where the competition was. When I qualified, that was like, it's a feeling I never experienced before. It's very hard to explain it into words, but it's like, wow, imagine you're working your entire life for something and you have achieved it. You've got it. Like, you've achieved that, like, that level, at the highest level that you can possibly do, and you got it. And that was kind of like, whoa. And at the same time, it was kind of like a little bit of bittersweet moment. It was like, you fight it and then you finally achieve it. And it's like, wow, okay, what's next?
What's next?
Yeah. I had that moment, but when I was driving back, it was a weird sensation. I was happy and stoked. But at the same time, I felt kind of like, I'm not sure what to feel about this. It was a very confusing feeling. Till this day, I can't really explain what it was, how it was. But the next moment, when I was in the Rio, when I was going into, because before in the preparation, I was basically considering myself, avoid any injuries, because that one injury can lead you, you know, if there's one hamstring tear, that's it, you're done, you can't compete. And you qualify, that's one part. Then staying healthy is a whole nother game. And then I was very fortunate that I was healthy enough that I could compete. There was nothing wrong. I felt great, except I didn't have that much of a jumps in my bucket that would lead me to a more comfortable technique. But yeah, when I was walking inside into the stadium, this is the moment that I actually realized, okay, you made this. Like, this is where it came. Like, you made it. But now while I was walking, it was like a very peaceful, a joyful, and just a whole room of emotions, pleasantness from within going to the stadium and then competing. And when I was competing, it's like, oh, wow. It was a lot of pressure. It was. I won't shy away from that. I was kind of very focused, like, I got to make this, you know, each jump is so important for me to get into the finals, because this was the next step. I got to jump higher so I can get into the finals, so I can fight for that medal. That's why you go to the Olympics, right? You don't go just to compete there. You go to the win. That's everyone's mentality there. At least, you know, from my experience.
Yeah.
And then, going to the warm-up stadium and then in the competition and starting to jump and competing. And then hearing the news, you got into the finals. I was like, wow, another amazing feeling.
Wow.
Very, very stoked feeling. And then, yeah, then I was just like, I could not sleep. I was just too much adrenaline, too much of it, and didn't know how to cope with that feeling. And even though, like, I had done a lot of meditations and a lot of mindfulness, it's very hard to control those kind of emotions in the first time. It takes practice. It takes practice like anything.
Yeah. How do you know how to calm your emotions in the Olympics unless you've done it before?
Exactly.
You don't understand being in that position until you're in that position.
Exactly. You can practice mentally as much as you can, but when you're put into that scenario, it's a whole different game.
Yeah. Who had your back at that time? Like, who would you go to when you're at the Olympics to talk to about how you're feeling or get support or feel like, you know, you have that?
Yeah. Those were two main people in my life. Tyler Frazier, he was the coach in University of Memphis. He coached me all the way until Rio. And my brother, Carlos Pujats. So both of them, I had both those individuals who really helped me, you know, go through it.
Yeah. Your brother was with you at the Olympics?
Yeah, he was.
So at that point, the competition was over.
Well, he had his own goals of, like, you know, making sure I qualify for the Rio, I compete there, I go into finals and, you know, fight for the medal.
Yeah.
But the goals changed from beating me to helping me.
Isn't that beautiful?
It really is. Literally, you said it perfectly. It really is beautiful how it changes, you know.
Absolutely. Wow. So you're in the finals, right? And now suddenly the competition is just leveled up, right? I mean, it's just, you know, the best of the best of the Olympians there with you. Did that add any additional amount of pressure, or was it just so taxing anyway that, you know, it was pressure regardless of whether you were in the finals or not?
I mean, yeah, the pressure was there.
Yeah.
What actually kind of took me really away from the really focusing and being completely in there, distraction. I guess you could find it as an excuse. I hate putting excuses, anything like that, but, like, really that mentally kind of was challenging for me because I was not practicing enough to do well in that kind of scenario, that situation. It started to pour rain right when the competition started. And then it was really, really raining. And, you know, for that grip, imagine the smallest little thing can get in the way, particularly if you don't feel comfortable. And that discomfort, it is important to feel comfortable in discomfort. But that rain, and I have like this sticky tape that I have on my hand and also sticky spray, and it was not gripping well, like it was sliding. And that uncomfortable sensation when you go into the plant, it's just completely takes away the focus of, like, you need to focus on the jump, not on your grip. And if you have that smallest little thought into you, this is going to mess up your entire jump. Simply because in the back of your mind, in your subconscious, you're thinking about your grip, not actually competing, not actually like jumping, you know, the technique. So that kind of get in the way of me to really fully go to my potential. But you live and you learn.
Yeah. Well, they say you learn more from failure than you do from success.
Very true.
So when you didn't win the gold, when you didn't get there, was it very disappointing? Did you feel as though you were, you know, it was all a loss? Or did you feel built up and expanded and ready to take on more things?
I think it only comes once in 4 years. And I guess I haven't added this one before. You know, I tried to qualify for London Olympics, which was in 2012, and I missed out 10 centimeters, which is like 2 inches, you know, like this much, nothing. and then after 4 years, so it was 8 years that I was practicing trying to get to the Olympics, and I finally did get to them. So that was great. I mean, I achieved already the goal, but obviously when you achieve some goal, it's like, okay, I want more, you know? It's always this human mentality in mind, like, I want more. Never satisfied.
Yeah, they say the nature of life is to grow.
Yeah, I agree. It's beautiful, but you got to celebrate the things that you already achieved. I think that's very important because the life goes by very quickly, very fast. Yeah, and if you focus on the next thing, you kind of miss those small, like little victories, which are great, which are the big ones actually. And in the competition, the most devastation, I guess, was that I did not clear the beginning height. The beginning height was quite high, actually. It was 5 meters 50, which is about 18 feet 6 inches, I think. 18 feet 6 inches. So it's still pretty high for, particularly if, you know, if I haven't practiced that height to clear with the first jump. And I ran through 2 times, which I didn't even make any attempts to jump. And the third one, I was so high over, but I was so worried about my hand grip slipping. I put so much of the sticky stuff. When I was launching myself from the pole stuck to me and I couldn't get it away. And I was already over the bar, but the pole was stuck. Wow. And then, you know, it ripped me back and then I just landed right on the bar. It's like, it was such a devastation, you know, because I finally made a jump. I might have made that attempt. You know, I tried, but it was unsuccessful. It was a hard punch to swallow. But yeah, whenever you experience it, because so many people are watching you and, you know, your support behind you. And because you're not only there by yourself, like you're there with a whole team.
Whole country,
yeah. And even from the United States, all the people I've competed in the University of Memphis and all my friends in the United States. So yeah, that was kind of like a hard punch to swallow, you know, to say the least.
Yeah. Well, to me, it feels really inspiring to see how many people have your back over time. As you start to get success and failure and success and compound and build strength, I think perhaps you gave other people strength and you gave other people something to root for. Absolutely. Your brother got fully vested in you. So you inspired people around you and you inspired them to be better based on what discipline you put in and on your dreams and your goals that you were fulfilling. So you definitely impacted a community. And so you and I met because of what you're working on now. And you're also continuing to look to impact communities and taking on challenges and all of that. And I find it very interesting what you're doing now. So why don't you tell me a little bit about it?
It's a completely different field, but still related to extreme sports. It still is. Yeah, honestly, this project is even more important for me than I feel like the Olympics, honestly, in the level that I could help the whole team, the project could help people. And when you're a professional athlete, you kind of have to be selfish simply because you have to really devote yourself to that sport, to that event. But this project is, you know, me learning extreme sports in all nature elements. And, you know, the first element is element of water and the sport of cliff diving. And I have a professional cliff diver who is going to teach me and who is already teaching me how to do cliff diving. And we already got the first episode shot in Hawaii. And it was a great success, amazing new things that I learned that I did not expect at all to learn. Did not thought they were important as well at the same time. And some crazy stories as well that we included into that episode. So, and we also include various experts in various fields, particularly in the health and wellness field.
You're taking on physical challenges that are varied through all different of Mother Nature's elements. So you're starting with cliff diving, which is water. And so had you done any cliff diving prior to filming your first pilot for this new project?
I have done cliff jumping, and there's a big difference between cliff diving and cliff jumping.
All right, so explain that
cliff
difference.
Cliff jumping is, yeah. So cliff jumping is when you land on your feet. So there's no twisting, there's no, you know, backflips, there's no flips involved in it. Cliff diving starts when you shift your body 180 degrees. So, which is that'd be if you're starting from the legs, finishing with the hands in the water, or vice versa, you know, and have flips in the air. So that's the difference between cliff diving and cliff jumping. I've done cliff jumping, but not cliff diving.
Wow.
In the first episode, I can tell you a little bit more about this. I was blown away. When I actually stood on the edge of the cliff and seeing Dan jumping off, and there were two other people, and it was about 16, 20 meters high to super high, like, you know, at least twice the height that I'm used to jumping in the pool and then landing on my back. And it's a different gymnastic, different type. I was like, whoa, my gut drops down just by thinking me like, I'm going to have to jump. I'm going to have to do this. I was like, what did I sign myself up for?
Wow. So, how did it go?
I'm always committed.
Yeah. How did it go?
Well, the thing is, I still just cliff jumped. I have not cliff dived yet because it takes practice. I can't just do it in 1 week. Like, it takes, you know, preparation. It takes practice to do something like that. And this is the importance, what we want to share as well, because not even jumping into the water. What do you think was the most important? What is the most challenging thing actually in cliff diving? You know, when you're in the cliff in the ocean?
I would say.
And your thoughts?
Landing. Like making sure that you land. I would say landing, like, okay, in a dive, you want to be able to land, or not land, I should say, like enter the water, you know, with that point. I would think so. Is that right?
That's one of the two most important ones, but even harder just in the landing, because yeah, you can land, and if you get unconscious, then you can drown. But the most important part is actually getting out of the water. Because no one pays attention to the water as being like threatening for them. It's the soft cushion to land in. The waves are insanely crazy there. From the bottom of the feet, where the water is, it can change to the top of the ceiling in just a second, like instantly. And imagine those rocks, when you're trying to crawl out of the water, they're razor sharp. And then there's sea urchins, and then slippery. And you're trying to walk there and being smacked with that wave of massive wave. You just get drowned in there. You know, you can just cheese grate it on the reef or on the rocks, what Dan likes to say. And first time, actually, when I jumped in the water, just out of curiosity, Dan told me, like, try it, you know. And the waves are pretty high at that point. When I was getting out of the water, and there was like, for this part, there was a rope. And it was when I was trying to walk up, it was super slippery. And then there's one huge wave literally just ate me. And then when I was going back, it was trying to slide my feet onto that cliff. And I tried to like catch my balance, and I just started to crawl as quick as I can, because otherwise, like, it would literally smash me on the wall and literally cheese grate me on the side of my body. When I got out of the water, I was very lucky. Like Dan even said, like, I was surprised you got out of the water so quick. But it's only because I have a skill set before, you know, I'm bringing to it. Like, I have athletic abilities before already. That's why I could take upon this. Other people, I'm not sure, you know, they might not have that speed or that strength to pull themselves out.
Yeah.
But when I was standing outside on the edge of the cliff, you know, for a while, like comprehending, oh my gosh, I did not expect that. I look at my feet and I see just blood on bottom of the feet, because those rocks are so sharp, they just cut you right through easily.
Wow.
So
wow.
That was my first experience.
You know, it sounds like you might be, Paul's, an adrenaline junkie.
I don't know.
It sounds like it. I'll tell you what, though, I never thought about that. But yeah, I mean, getting out, like diving off of a cliff into treacherous waters, sounds like it's a two-part situation. First, it's diving and making sure, like you said, that you land and that you don't go unconscious. Mm-hmm. And then number two is once you've dived, you need to get out. which isn't something that you think about when you dive into a pool, right? So an Olympic swimmer, you know, who's diving has no consideration about, you know, sea urchins are drowning in massive waves in a live, living body of water. I mean, I can tell you, I am so privileged to have had this conversation with you. We're going to do one more question, and I'm going to pull it out of my deck here. I have this deck. It's called What's Your Word? And it's going to be totally random. Okay.
All right.
Last question. Totally random. See, it's called What's Your... I don't think you can see it. No, you can't see it. But that's okay. I'm going to read it out to you anyway. So.
Love. In one word, love.
Yeah. Absolutely. That is one of my top five values I just discovered is love. And the world can never get enough of it. And so I can tell that you have a lot of love, clearly, in the way that you're mentoring and you're continuously pushing the limits of your life and making connections and building relationships. And it's an honor to talk to you and to learn all about your story. I'm looking forward to partnering with you and seeing what we could do together. So thank you for joining the show. If you want to learn more about Paul's Pujats, if you want to learn about this project, you can see the information. It's right down there in the description. Please click there. And you can also support Paul's by going to his website. What's your website, Paul's?
It's my last name, pujats.org. So it's easy Pujats, to find.
Easy. Go to pujats.org. Go check him out. He's awesome. And he will motivate you. That was a fantastic conversation with Paul's Pujats. And remember, if you'd like to hear more about the organizations that Paul is supporting, organizing, more about his TV show, just go to pujats.org. That's pujats.org. And remember to listen to the Alchemist Lounge podcast, formerly Off the Clock, that's available anywhere you can get podcasts. That's Spotify, that's Apple, and we even have videos on YouTube. So check us out. Until next time, onward and upward.
Thanks for listening in to the Alchemist Lounge. If you enjoyed this episode and you'd like to help support the podcast, please share it with others, post about it on social media, or leave a rating and review on Apple iTunes. To catch all the latest from Alex Atwood, you can check out his website at alexatwood.co. Thanks again, and we'll catch you next time at the Alchemist Lounge.